that's true. Amy, I'm not sure it ever stops. And their emergencies just get bigger. It's not like they're hungry. It's that they need money for get them out of jail or something.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, we'll hear what happened on Flight 1549. You know, that plane that miraculously landed on the Hudson River.
Next, a survival guide for multitasking moms.
Then,
while on the moving sidewalk, please stand to the right.
Sound familiar? We'll chat with the man behind that voice.
Plus, surprising revelations about modern parenting.
And we'll shoot the breeze about an art festival not to be missed. Brace for impact. Three terrifying words air travelers never want to hear. The passengers and attendants aboard ill-fated Flight 1549, the one which Captain Sullenberger masterfully piloted, heard those exact words moments before their plane landed on the Hudson River that cold January day in 2009.
155 passengers and crew became unexpected heroes that day. Their stories and heart-stopping wills to survive are brought to life in National Geographic's movie, Miracle on the Hudson. Doreen Welsh, an experienced air steward with over 38 years of service, was aboard that miracle flight and joins us from Pittsburgh to tell us what happened. Welcome, Doreen.
Thank you.
And I must say, we're so glad you're here to tell us about this.
Yes, I'm glad I'm here to share the story also.
Now, Doreen, this was the last leg of a very long day for you. Was everything par for the course, or did something really kind of feel amiss, even, you know, at odds before the flight took off?
Oh, no, everything was normal. It was a four-day trip that we were on, and this was the last leg. We were on our way back to Charlotte. Nothing different or, you know, just another flight.
Well, some of the passengers, you know, we've read that they reported that they felt kind of odd, uncomfortable, but maybe that is par for the course. I know I'm saying like my Hail Marys before I take off.
Well, I guess it's different for me because it's what I did. Well, it's what I did do for a living. So I don't even think of it. It's just another flight.
During seconds after the flight takes off, Captain Sullenberger's voice comes over the PA saying, as we said, brace for impact. Did that take you by surprise, or did you even know something had gone terribly wrong?
Oh, yeah, I knew something was wrong because it was 2 minutes into the flight when it was like we hit something in midair, and there was a loud boom, and the airplane kind of jolted. And I had assumed that we just perhaps lost an engine for some reason. I wasn't alarmed yet. In fact, I was annoyed, thinking we're going to be late. So I thought, well, we just have to circle around, which happens, and go back and land and get it repaired or wait for a new aircraft or whatever it was going to be. But then that burning odor came through the aircraft. I thought maybe we had a fire somewhere. So still not hearing anything from the cockpit, I got out of my seat and I checked my galley. I thought it might be an electrical fire. Everything was cold and fine there. So I took a stroll through the cabin. We're still very low. And I was just feeling the overheads for heat or fire, couldn't find anything. And we're just floating over Manhattan in silence because no engines. Hmm. And we still hadn't heard anything from the cockpit. So I thought, well, they're really busy. We're over New York airspace, for heaven's sakes. I better sit down because we're just going to land and get this repaired. And just as I went back to my seat and sat down and fastened my seatbelt, that's when we heard brace for impact.
So what was going on in the cabin at this time? How were the passengers reacting to all this? Did they realize that there were no engines, first of all?
They realized something was wrong because I walked halfway through the cabin, and on my way back, I'm telling everybody we're going to land and get this fixed, so just make sure your seatbelt is still on. It should have been because we had just taken off. But I said, we'll go back and get this fixed. Everything will be okay. I'm assuring them. And I said, you know, we're probably just going to land. They don't have time to tell us. Just make sure your seatbelts are still fastened. And then I went back and sat down, and that's when we heard brace for impact.
Doreen, we cannot even imagine the violence of the impact. Can you describe it for us?
Well, violent is the right word. The airplane hit back first where I was, and the damage was all done on the aircraft, the last six rows and in the back. And it was just like hitting a wall. And everything flew out in the galley, the carts, the masks had dropped and from the overheads in the last six rows because that's where the impact was. And it shook, and it was a horrible, scary feeling.
Now, you were in a jump seat, right?
Yes.
So how did you even stay secure? Or did you?
Well, I jolted forward. I mean, the flight attendants, besides having a seatbelt, also have shoulder harnesses, but I still jolted forward with that. And then on impact, a steel pole came up through the floor with an angle wiring on the end and went through my leg.
Oh.
And I didn't even feel it. I didn't even know it until way later, because that amount of adrenaline from when he said brace for impact, you things like that, you don't even, I mean, could you, you know, if that happened to you just sitting here right now, I'm sure it was very, very painful, but I didn't feel it because my adrenaline was sky high.
When did you actually realize that the plane had landed on the Hudson and not on the tarmac?
Well, after the impact, everything goes into a slow motion, warped kind of feeling for a while. And I thought maybe we were dead. I didn't know until the captain opened the door because the interphones weren't working and said, evacuate, evacuate. And I thought we had crashed on the tarmac going back to LaGuardia. And I became all full of hope and thought, I have two doors back here. I'll start assigning passengers and doing all of my everything I'm trained to do, you know, having to stand back till I assess, get doors open, get people to help me, you know, hold the slides and do this. And I had to go back to the first door and look through the porthole, and all I saw was water.
Well, during after the landing, can you describe the situation inside the plane? I mean, was it total chaos? I can't even imagine.
It wasn't total chaos, but I've been asked this, and the only way I can describe it is because I had to shout so many commands constantly that I drowned out the others, because first I had to yell, stand back, and so I'm assessing everything. I'm trying to keep everybody out of the galley, because once I decided that the water level was too high for me to get the wraps open in the back, I had to get people moving forward. So I was screaming and pushing and then coming back and assessing what I had to do and trying to do. I was busy. So what happened, you know, four or five rows past what I could see, I really didn't know, because I was just handling everything I could handle in my area. And I was yelling so loud that I don't honestly know if anybody else was. I don't remember screaming. I just remember a bustling and I had told people that you need to start climbing over seats if you're able, because there was not time for us to all go up the aisle like you were deplaning.
And were the passengers orderly, or were they panicky? Were they, you know, rushing past each other to get out?
Well, both. There was a lot in the back, frozen in shock, that were doing nothing. So they managed to get out of their seats. They were standing. But after that, they didn't move. Wow. And that's what I had to do, was to get them moving.
And how did you do that?
Screaming, pushing, whatever I had to do. I mean, I was shoving, yelling, grabbing. I was grabbing people by the shoulders and pushing them forward. Anything I had to do to get that movement started.
And what about the wounded? How did they get out?
I was the only wounded person at that point, and I didn't even know I was. Now I'm in ice water. By the time I left, I was in ice water up to my neck. So everything was numb. I didn't even know about my leg or anything yet. And the people that were injured was from jumping out of the plane or doing something after they got out. No one got wounded on the impact except myself.
And then, Doreen, we understand that the flooring immediately ripped up and water flooded in, and there were differing accounts of how and when the rear door of the plane was actually opened. Can you tell us?
The rear door was never, ever opened.
Oh, okay.
If the rear door had opened, half the people would have died. A woman came back and attempted to open, and since I was the only flight attendant back there, I really had my hands full. I had to get rid of her. I had to protect those doors at all costs because that water level was too high. Had a door opened, that water would have flushed halfway through the cabin, and half the people would have died.
Oh, so how did the water came in from the floor then when the plane ripped apart?
2 feet behind me, a big hole came from the impact, came through. But I did not see it because it was instantly flushed with water, as was, you know, the floor instantly had a few inches of water before I even got out of my jump seat. So I didn't know about that hole. And 6 months later, I went to see the aircraft when it was in a hangar in New Jersey. And I thought I probably had come within inches of that hole, because if I had stepped into it, it would have been over. And it just gave me the chills for nightmares for a long, long time, because I was doing things around that area that I had to do, clearing up the debris and keeping the people out of the way and doing what I had to do. And I thought, I bet inches I was away from that. And that's where all the water came in, that hole.
Our guest is Doreen Welsh, air steward aboard the infamous Flight 1549 that Captain Sullenberger successfully landed on the Hudson River. I'm Kathy Bernard, and my co-host is Barbara Klein. You can listen to this show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Doreen Welsh about what went on in the passenger cabin on that fateful day. Doreen, there were so many heroes on Flight 1549, yourself included. Can you tell us one of the most profound heroic stories that just kind of remains in the forefront of your mind?
Well, like I said, I didn't see a lot what happened forward, but what I think, I give a lot of credit to the passengers who were at the window exits and who took the windows out and initiated their exit out of the aircraft onto the wings. I'm very proud of them. They did a great job. And a lot of the passengers we had on board were frequent flyers. They were business travelers, which was wonderful because we only had two children on board, a four-year-old and a baby. Because we've often said, if this flight had been going to Orlando with families, it would have been a whole different ballgame. It was all adults except for that one family. So I think that made the world of difference.
Doreen, let me ask you about Captain Sullenberger. I mean, of course, he's hailed as a hero, and he's you know, and it seems like an incredible man. What was your interaction before with him, before this flight? Did you know him at all?
No. In fact, none of us knew each other before. All five of us met on that first day of that four-day trip.
And what was his presence like during the whole ordeal?
I never saw him. He was up front. I was in the back. I never saw him.
Interesting. And so are you still in contact with Captain Sullenberger to this day?
He's very busy. I'm in touch with Jeff Skiles, the first officer, and I'm very close with, in fact, she had just called me, Sheila Dale, one of the flight attendants, very close. We talk. She lives in North Carolina. Unfortunately, you know, we don't get to see each other often, but we don't let more than 3 weeks go by without a phone call to each other. We just need that contact because we just do. Someone you went through something like that with. So Sheila and I became very close.
Doreen, was there a moment when you thought, when it maybe just flashed in your mind, that you might not make it out alive?
Oh, many times. Well, when I almost drowned from the neck up water, and it was rising so fast, and, you know, the ceiling was over my head, I thought that was it. I thought, the first time I thought it was when I heard brace for impact, and then I guess when I looked out and saw nothing but water, I thought, well, this is it. So, yeah, there were many moments, but I think the most was whenever that water was rising so rapidly.
And how did you keep from not panicking? Is that all your incredible training and 38 years of experience on board?
Yes. I could not believe how the training kicked in. Because we, besides our initial training, we go back once or twice, at least once a year for recurrent, and then sometimes for added training, usually more than once a year for our training. And we reenact all of these. We have to do our entire evacuation process. They have mock-ups and everything in the training center. So, yes, it's unbelievable how training kicks in.
And Doreen, let me ask you about the birds, because as you said, you know, the birds flew into the engines, which caused them to fail. Is that still a big problem on many runways in the United States?
I hear LaGuardia still has a problem. It's something about a garbage area out near the outside of the runways. So I don't know how they can, what they're doing to control it. But I think what happened to us, I've had a bird strike before in New Orleans years ago, but it was one engine. So we were able to circle around and land and everything. But the way that it was so freaky, the way that all of these geese came at one time and separated and went into both engines like they did.
That's unusual.
Yeah.
But bird strikes aren't that unusual, right?
No, they are not.
A little scary.
Yes,
this really must have been a life-changing event for you. How has it affected your own life?
Oh, I have a whole new career because of it. I'm speaking professionally now for the last 4 years, so I was able to retire. They gave us a long time to think about it. We were not allowed to go back to work for almost a year. So I had a long time to think about what I wanted to do. And I did some charity events, and they said, well, tell us your story. And I found that I'm not that uncomfortable. So I put together a presentation and got with a few speaking bureaus. And now I travel around the country and tell my story, which the name of my speech is called 90 Seconds to Impact.
Do you still fly?
Well, I have to fly to all my speeches. Yeah, I mean, people ask me that. The first flight I had to take was I had to fly home from New York after I go to the hospital. And then for the next year, the crew was everywhere being honored and doing. So I had to fly to all of that. And now I fly for a living, but just in a different way.
Is it more difficult to be in a plane these days after your ordeal?
Yes. Yes.
I would imagine.
Also see the side, which I find pretty humorous, the passenger versus the flight attendant. Now I kind of see some of their points.
Oh, good. That's a whole nother story, right?
Yes.
There's a whole other story there because I could see both sides. It's not easy flying today, as you know. It's just, it's very stressful.
It is stressful. Well, Doreen, real quickly, if you had to kind of just wrap it up, sum it up, you know, what lesson would you like our listeners to really take away from your amazing story?
I guess the old common that life is short. And one of the things I say at the end of my speech, because of the 90 seconds I had to think about my life, because it was 90 seconds till we crashed. And you don't want to have any loose ends. You don't want to say, well, I'll handle that tomorrow, because there may not be a tomorrow. I got a second chance to fix some things in my life that did need fixed, and not everybody does. So that's something that take seriously, and just to be grateful for every day that you're given, because it's a blessing.
Doreen Welsh, air steward aboard the infamous Flight 1549 that successfully landed in the Hudson River, thank you so much for sharing your amazing story and those of other heroes aboard that flight.
Thank you for having me. Have a nice day.
This story is brought to life in the movie Miracle Landing on the Hudson, which can be seen on the National Geographic Channel. Moms do a lot of juggling with the endless responsibilities of raising children and all that goes with it, keeping up with our share of home duties, career assignments, and any volunteer committees we've agreed to chair. Yes, we're super multitaskers. So how do we do it all without going stark raving mad?
As a mom and multitasker herself, Amy Newmark decided to share her tips and those of other busy moms and pass along their best advice. Her new book is called Chicken Soup for the Soul, Multitasking Mom's Survival Guide. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, I have to tell you that Kathy and I have been out of the small kid world for a long time. Our kids are grown, but we thought we'd get your advice to really share with our girls who might be having kids in the next decade.
Yeah, exactly.
God willing.
And I'm in the same position because my son is getting married 3 days from now.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, so I've got the grown kids who are in their 20s also. But I have to say, I think my multitasking went all the way through those college years, because that's when they have those dire emergencies where you're FedExing things.
That's
true. Amy, I'm not sure it ever stops.
And their emergencies just get bigger. It's not like they're hungry.
Right?
It's that they need money for get them out of jail or something.
Or they need me to babysit the dog. A few weeks ago, I drove 300 miles round trip to go pick up my daughter's dog and bring the dog home because she couldn't make the trip because she's in medical school and she needed me to take the dog for a couple of weeks.
Well, you are a good mom.
Well, you know how moms are. This is what we do. And when the kids are grown, we're still there, willing to do anything for them.
Anything. Hop on an airplane.
Well, I have my limits, I have to say. And they've been tested within the past few weeks, too. But Amy, let me ask you, so what prompted you to write a survival guide for moms? Was it personal experience?
Yeah, because I keep coming up with new ideas for books that I wish had been available to me. And so, like, when my kids finished applying to college and I had gone through that, as my daughter was leaving to go off to Georgetown, and she was the last one to go off to college, and it had been so traumatic, that whole experience, I said, I wish there had been a book for me about getting kids into college, and a book that I could have read and that my kids could have read, you know, a book of emotional support, not a how-to, but just a, this is how it feels, and everybody feels the same way. And this Multitasking Moms book is the same idea. I've been noticing that I've been giving a lot of advice to the people who are coming up behind me, friends who are 5 or 10 years behind me, and they still have kids at home. And I kept giving them advice, and then I started putting the advice in my national newspaper column. And then I said, I got to put these all in a book and gather advice from all these other moms and make a book that gives the best advice, practical tips that you can really implement, and emotional support to those multitasking moms out there. Because it's emotional support, too, because I remember when I had the kids at home, you're basically the CEO of your household, and it's lonely at the top. And you can't tell your husband because then he thinks you're complaining. Or if you don't have a husband, there's no one to tell anyway. And so I thought, this is like a portable support group. All these moms coming together, sharing their best advice, sharing their funny stories about disasters, sharing those guilty feelings sometimes, like, why am I even doing this? I want to hop on a plane to Bora Bora, and, you know, all of those stories. So we've got 101 of them in here. They're short, quick reads for that busy mom who has 5 minutes to herself every day.
Well, Amy, I want to ask you about some of the goodies that are in your book, because they sure did ring a bell. And at a very early age, you actually gave your kids their own budget?
I did.
Yeah, well, that's ingenious. So did that actually work?
It worked so incredibly well. I'm pretty sure my kids will do the same thing. So what happened was, you know, I'd buy them their clothes and there'd always be negotiations. And then my son, being like most people's sons, he kept losing his clothes. And the last straw was when he came home from school one day, and he went to a private school where the boys had to wear a navy blue blazer. And I had bought him, you know, a slightly too large blazer that was supposed to last him for the whole school year. You know, it was $100. I didn't want him to lose it. And he came home from school like the first week, and he was wearing some ratty old blazer that wasn't going to fit him all year. I said, where's your brand new blazer? And he said, oh, I gave it to Gideon because his was too small, so we traded.
Oh my gosh.
I said, all right, you're getting your own clothing budget. And it worked out really well. So my daughter, she wanted a debit card. My son wanted a savings account where he could go and get cash once in a while. And so they had their own method for it. I would still drive them to the store because they were only preteens when we started this. And they would shop using their money. I would shop using my money. And it was more like shopping with a girlfriend. We'd show each other what we were buying, but at cash register time, they would pay for themselves. Their father and I would, you know, give them their money every 6 months so that if they blew it all, at least in 6 months, they would have another. And I remember one time my son went to Ralph Lauren and bought ridiculously expensive shorts, and then we had to go back because he had to return them when he realized he had blown his budget on the shorts.
Well, that's a good life lesson. Skill. It worked, really is.
It worked so well because they became very responsible. And my son still lost things occasionally, but I didn't care anymore because it wasn't my problem.
Well, Amy, multitasking moms, as we know, they just go at a frantic pace. But one of the stories you captured is about a mom who decided she wasn't paying enough attention to her son and dropped everything. And we love that story. Can you tell it real quickly?
I love that story. So she said something about how she was so busy being a mom that she forgot to be a mom. She went back to what was the most precious in her life, which was spending time with her kids, before being a busy mom made me too busy to be a mom. And what she did was she realized that she was neglecting her young son, and she realized that she should devote an hour to him several times a week. So they had what they called special hour. And during that hour, she would do absolutely nothing. There would be no phone calls, no electronic devices, nothing. It was just an hour with him at the park, playing a board game, whatever he wanted to do. And they did it several times a week. And it was a really wonderful time. And it fits into our whole theme in this book about slowing down. Don't do so much. Don't push yourself as hard. The best mom is a happy mom. And your kids really want your time and attention more than they want, you know, all those crazy things you're doing, like making the most beautiful cupcakes from scratch. Like, who cares? Go buy them at the store. Because that stuff doesn't really matter. What really matters is the love and attention.
And you know what? It goes by so quickly. When you're in it, in the throes of it, you think, oh my gosh, am I going to, you know, live till tomorrow? Because you're so overwhelmed and exhausted. But if you just, you're right, sit down and enjoy and look at those precious faces, because pretty soon they'll be walking down the aisle.
Exactly. I know the feeling. So the other thing that I make a big point of in the book is, I wrote a story called It Doesn't Have to Be Perfect, and I have stories from other moms on the same theme. Moms, we want everything to be absolutely perfect all the time. We want to do everything to the utmost, but it's just not possible. And really, if a mom even did everything at the 90% level, she would be the superhero of all moms. And so I learned after a while, having a family gathering, paper plates, not china, plastic cups, not crystal that I'm going to have to hand wash. I learned that it was okay to buy takeout sometimes. It was okay to buy stuff at a bakery instead of baking it myself. It was okay to skip the Christmas cards 1 year because it was just too hard getting everyone together for a photo, and I just didn't have the hours it would take to do that. You can make all of these compromises, and they actually make you a better mother, not a worse mother.
Exactly.
I find that the kids will forgive you way more than you'll forgive yourself for these things. I don't know why we all beat ourselves up over these things, and that's why we have a whole chapter in the book about feeling guilty and how moms shouldn't feel guilty. And so we have all these examples of moms who were feeling guilty and then explain why they shouldn't have felt that way. And I know you can best learn by your own experience, but second best is to learn through these very personal, heartfelt stories that are shared with you. So hopefully reading these stories will help these moms be a little more relaxed, make some me time for themselves, don't try to be perfect in everything, and see the humor in all of those everyday disasters as well.
Well, Amy Newmark, co-author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, Multitasking Mom Survival Guide, this has been fun. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much.
Up next, the man behind the voice at the airport.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up at 5.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You've probably never met our next guest in person, but his voice may be surprisingly familiar. That's because he can be heard over 100 airports across the country, gently reminding us that smoking inside the terminal is prohibited or unattended baggage will be removed immediately.
Jack Fox is the man behind that voice. He joins us by phone to tell us about how he conquered the sound waves in major transportation systems around the U.S. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, Jack, could you do one of your messages so listeners will get a sense of your voice and really how familiar it is?
All right. You ready?
Sure.
While on the moving sidewalk, please stand to the right to allow those wishing to walk to pass safely on the left.
I love it. Go. I've heard that 10 million times.
I've heard that.
Yeah,
that's
it's been
amazing.
10 million times, I'm sure.
So. Next time when I hear that, Jack, I'm going to look up to the sky and I'm going to say, hi, Jack.
I'll be looking down on you in spirit at least. You know?
Right, and we're going to pay attention this time.
That's
we'll
right.
really move to the right.
Well, unlike my family, you'll probably pay attention. So.
Well, you know, I always thought the voices we heard in airports were computer-generated. I didn't know there were real people behind them.
Well, that day may come, but most of the voices now are still a lady named Carolyn Hopkins, who worked with me here in Louisville. She's now retired and lives in Maine, but still does them. She's the lady's voice you hear, and then I do most of the others. There are some local airports that, you know, insert their own voices, but I'm in about 100 airports around the country. She's probably more than that.
Well, airports, as we all know, can be extremely stressful. But, you know, your voice really is genuinely warm and really almost comforting.
You know, I get more people tell me that. They fly.
Yeah.
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, and they come in to say, it was just so great to have you welcome me when I got home.
Oh.
Or I had a lady one time who I'd worked with at the television station here in Louisville who had been on a business trip to New York. And the weather was bad. Flight got delayed to Detroit. She was in the Detroit airport for 4 hours. She said, you don't know how comforting it was to hear your voice. Even though you were telling me not to smoke, I just felt at home, you know.
It's so great.
You do it in such a nice
you
way.
You do.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that.
It must just come naturally, obviously, then.
I guess so. I was a disc jockey on the radio for
years.
Oh,
there you go. Now, Jack, I have to ask you, you said Louisville. I don't hear any type of a southern drawl in your voice.
I'm originally from this area, but I work in Kansas City and in Denver. And when you're in the media, you sort of get that generic tone to your voice also.
Just like Barb and Kathy.
Yeah, I would pay attention to a Southern accent in the airport somehow. Well, Jack, tell us about the recording process. Do you have to do a lot of takes for this?
No, not very much. I'm a one-take reader most of the time. There's a studio here in Louisville that I go to. They have a little studio. Again, they give me the copy that's been approved by the TSA, and we read it, just a few takes, and we're ready to go.
So I guess you can't really ad-lib if the TSA
is giving you the script. No. Word for word.
Yeah, really. You say move to the right or move to the left, just a little bit, you know.
Please, help.
Please, pretty please.
Yeah, right. Interestingly enough, back maybe a year or so ago, I was called in to do one for a tornado warning. Mm. I thought, I've never heard of one at an airport. A week later is when the one in St. Louis took place, and since then there have been several, so that was good timing.
And that was quite a tornado,
really
I know.
Was, yes.
I actually saw Lambert Airport after that hit Lambert, and oh, that was
frightening. Actually, we were watching Diane Sawyer, who's from Louisville. We were watching her on ABC News here a while back, and a tornado had touched down in Denver at the airport, and the reporter is standing there reporting, and my voice is in the background. All clear has been sounded now. Very interesting.
You're like, oh, I sound so familiar.
Yeah, that's right.
Jack, how did you get your start in the voiceover business?
I was in radio for years. I started when I was in high school in a little town called Harvard, Illinois, outside Chicago. I tell people I graduated from Harvard at 17, and so they're impressed till they find the real truth. You know? But I was in radio, and then here in Louisville, I did a lot of voiceover work, and there was a company that had an electronic division that created a computerized paging service, a system that they use in airports so that announcements won't walk over other announcements. And they started supplying them in airports around the country in the mid-'80s sometime, I think. And in 1991, here in Louisville, when the Gulf War happened, they wanted to add, they had Carolyn doing all the voices, and they wanted to add a friendly yet authoritative male voice. And evidently I fit that bill, and that's when it started, back in 1991.
So, Jack, are you a freelancer, or do you actually work for a company?
No, I'm freelance, yes. In fact, we do most of the airport announcements. They've been recorded some time ago. We still add some new ones, like the tornado alert, or maybe some particular airport wants their name said. So we'll do some customized like that, but I'm strictly freelance.
Well, Jack, do you or your voice ever get recognized? I mean, does anybody ever ask for your autograph?
Not autograph, but it is interesting how people will recognize, even if they don't know a background, they'll say, you should be on the radio or something. You've got a radio voice. And well, you'd be surprised.
So have you ever been talking and somebody said, I know that voice?
Yes, yes, I have. Especially when I was on a radio station here in town, that happened a lot. People say, are you such and such? Or they'd recognize the voice. And I've been to airports before where they've said, are you that guy? I was renting a car at an airport one time, and a guy said, man, you sound a lot like that guy on that speaker up there. I said, that is me. He said, no, no way.
Well, what's that like to hear your voice in the airport? I mean, does it still stun you after all these years?
It depends on the situation. I don't want to get too graphic here, but I was flying from Louisville to Phoenix once and had to go through Minneapolis, and at 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm in the men's room, and I hear my voice making announcements. That's a little startling there, you know.
Well, Jack, what does your family think of all this fame you have?
Oh, they've lived with it all their lives. In fact, we were at an airport one time waiting for a rental car, and my 4-year-old granddaughter was standing there, and she got this puzzled look on her face as my voice kept cycling through, reminding people to look after their luggage and that sort of thing. And she looked at her mother and said, why is Grandpa talking so much? So she's used to it now. They're all used to it.
And we even understand that your daughter has joined the business?
Yes. I'm speaking to you right now from the American Printing House for the Blind here in Louisville. And we record books for the blind for the Library of Congress, for the National Library Service. And she does that. She also is on the local NPR station here in town and does voiceover work. Her name is Jill. She's very good.
Oh.
Now, I'll go into a studio somewhere where I haven't been for a while, and they'll say, oh, you're Jill Fox's dad. I used to be Jack Fox. Now I'm Jill Fox's dad.
I bet your daughter loves that one.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's great.
Well, real quickly, Jack, we hear that you view your work as really a public service. How so?
I was given a gift, and I can use it through the books here at the printing house and open a world for some people who have visual problems, or make people feel comfortable when they're stuck in a Detroit airport or been home and coming home from a long trip somewhere and just want to welcome home. So that's the way I view it.
voiceover artist Jack Fox. From now on, we'll be listening much more carefully when we're at the airport, we promise.
And please stand to the right so the airport police don't have to come after you.
Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. Nice to talk with you.
Four years ago, journalist Jennifer Senior wrote a cover article for New York Magazine, citing research concluding that parents are less happy than their childless peers. The article set off a firestorm of responses in the media and blogosphere.
Having clearly touched a nerve, Jennifer set off to explore how children change the lives of their parents, for better and sometimes for worse, and why parents today find their lives so challenging, especially compared to past generations. She interviewed ordinary parents about their deepest frustrations and rewards, and chronicled her findings in her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Jennifer, a mom herself, joins us on the phone. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jennifer, what do you mean by all joy and no fun?
Well, I stole that phrase from a friend of mine. It was a very adhesive, kind of sticky phrase. I had said to him, you know, how do you find new fatherhood? And that was his answer, all joy and no fun. And I was not a parent at the time. I think what it captured in this hyper-compressed, really beguiling kind of way was that there was a distinction between the two, first of all, and that the moment-to-moment nature of parenting might not always be fun, particularly in the early days. And he was in that early phase where, you know, days were blending into nights. But that the joy, you know, the transcendent kind of moments of meaning and purpose and structure that you have in those moments where you just have this kind of sense of unrivaled awe, you know, and majesty almost in your life suddenly, that's there too in this way that you never could have anticipated. So I thought that just sort of neatly captured, you know, a difference that we might not be accustomed to thinking about.
So why did you really decide to write this article that set off this incredible firestorm?
It's funny. I know people, it's been enshrined as something that kind of set off a firestorm when it came out. I write a lot about politics also for New York Magazine. And man, this story was a cakewalk compared to the kind of responses I get when I write a political story. I don't remember it being like especially volatile. I just remember people actually writing mostly appreciative stuff, because if you read all the way through the story, you saw both the good and the bad. What made me write it was I kept stumbling across this finding in social science that said that parents were not as happy as non-parents, or that there was no difference, essentially, that kids did not improve a person's well-being one iota and might even compromise a person's well-being. And this was very surprising to me. And it was not like one study that somebody did one time somewhere. It was a very robust body of literature, and it showed up in economics, it showed up in psychology, it showed up in sociology, it showed up when people weren't even looking for it. So I thought that is just bananas. You know, I mean, we are all trained to assume that kids are enormous sources of joy and that your life and overall quality of life improves enormously once a child comes along. So the idea that these findings were saying, you know, the opposite, or at least saying that this was not in fact true, was fascinating to me. So I just thought that this study deserved some kind of scrutiny. And here's what I found. Kids are not the problem, right? It's not kids. It's something about how we are parenting right now in 2014, or at the time it was 2010, that is the problem. So it opened up this space for me to talk about, like, what is it about raising kids that has made it so kind of hard for us and so challenging for us? It opened up this space for me to say, like, what's wrong with this study? You know, it's got to be incomplete. So that's what I did.
Right. So why are parents today more stressed out than those of a generation ago? And it seems like today's parents, it's like a 24/7 job. It's a verb, you know, and it wasn't quite that way when we were bringing our kids up. How do we get to this point?
Well, and you're so astute to bring that up because, you know, although parent as a verb has existed for a long time in the OED, it didn't really enter common usage until 1970. That's when people started treating it as a thing that one did. I mean, I can give three brief reasons that I think summarize a whole heck of a lot. I think the first thing is a historical thing that absolutely no one takes into account, which is that until much more recently than we probably realized, kids had an economic function in the home, right? They worked, and they were economic assets to their parents. It was only during the progressive era, like let's say, you know, by 1920, you know, I mean, between 1890 and 1920 is informally how one might describe the progressive era, but really only at the end of it were there all these kind of good child labor laws finally in place. But then there was the Depression, and, you know, nobody was working. And then there was the war, and the boys were off fighting the war, so kids were working again. Even in 1940, half of all American boys didn't graduate from high school. They were working. They were working. So only in 1950 did we even start having the kind of education-focused sheltered childhood as we know it. That's when it first began. So suddenly it became a parent's job to work for their kids, not for the kids to work for them. In the 1950s, it wasn't so bad because there wasn't a whole lot of income inequality. The world wasn't a very competitive place. But by the 1970s, wages were stagnating. And by the 1990s, the world was globalizing. And suddenly, parents panicked and said, oh, my God, I need to raise a super child in order to make sure that this child gets a kind of toehold in the middle class. So suddenly you had parents who were running all over creation on behalf of their children and spending tons of money on them, cultivating them within an inch of their lives, taking them to soccer practice and taking them to violin lessons and tutoring them and checking their homework. I mean, goodness knows, my mother barely had a passing acquaintance with my homework. But now
my mother didn't know my teacher.
Right, and she probably wasn't getting down on the floor and playing with you the minute you got home from school. I mean, and you weren't expecting her to. But mothers now spend more time playing with their kids than they did in the mid-60s, when mothers weren't even in the paid workforce. So this is kind of astonishing that we now believe that it's like kind of a full saturation immersion experience with our kids or nothing at all. That's the only thing that we'll do is full saturation. So that's one thing, and it's because we have this real anxiety about preparing them for this kind of rapidly changing world with a very rapidly shrinking middle class. So I think that that's one big thing, and kids have become very expensive, so we have to work very hard on their behalf. I think the U.S. Department of Agriculture recently came out with the scariest number I've ever heard, which is that a child born in 2010 to a middle class family will cost that family $300,000 to raise. And that does not include college.
Yeah, it is staggering.
It's staggering.
You're tuned in to Two Boomer Babes. We're talking with Jennifer Senior, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, about her new book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Jennifer, you interviewed a number of parents in your book, and the first ones we meet are Angie and Clint, who really see each other for 15 minutes a day. And with their mismatched work schedules, and just like you were talking about, this crazy sort of life that people live now, and each had very different approaches to parenting. So what did you really learn from talking with them?
What I took from them was this. Angie was incredibly hard on herself as a mother. She, like many mothers, multitasked when she was at home. Men, when they are at home, are much less likely to be multitasking. They are actually much more apt to be doing one thing at a time when they're at home. They multitask at work. Whereas Angie, she just, home to her was like a video game. She was like ducking and dodging debris, basically. So she would feel like she had to simultaneously cook dinner, play with the kids, put on an Elmo video so that one kid could learn how to be potty trained, try and clean, and also like field, you know, emails from colleagues about how the next day's schedule. She was doing 900 things at once because she wanted some portion of her attention to be devoted to the kids. She felt so guilty about her time at home that she was doing all these elaborate compensatory measures to be with her kid. Clint felt no such guilt. I mean, he did one thing at a time. He did not feel terrible if he put his kids in front of the television for 20 minutes and said, I have something else that I have to do. He actually talked about having me time. I mean, he used that phrase, me time, which Angie would never dreamed of using. I mean, she...
Because of the guilt, right?
No, right. She didn't think there was such a thing. I mean, she already had her work time. That was basically her me time. Then she was home and it had to be kid time. That was an insurmountable obstacle in terms of her own self-image. And so she couldn't see herself as a person who would allow herself 10 minutes every day.
But don't you think that's also part of a woman's DNA? I mean, Barbara and I are nodding. I mean, even our kids are grown, you know, they've flown the coop, and we still multitask like crazy people.
I don't feel entirely comfortable weighing in on how much is nature and how much is, you know, what is sort of acculturated. I think what one can say is that, I mean, yes, of course, when your baby is first born and you're breastfeeding and there's all this oxytocin sloshing around, I think one can safely assume that, yes, of course, some of this bonding is biologically driven. But I think you also have to take into consideration the kinds of mixed messages that women get about how okay it is for them to work. I just looked at a very recent Pew poll, which said that only 16% of Americans feel, like, totally comfortable, think that it's ideal if women have full-time jobs, 16%. And a full 50% think that the best arrangement for a child is for a woman to be home full-time. It's still very confusing, right? Because at the same time, other polls will also say that Americans are more accepting than ever of women being primary breadwinners.
Jennifer, I want to ask you real quickly. We were just amazed about the study that you cited about mothers and empty nests after their children leave home. And we were very surprised by the results that they're really, really happy people.
That's a pretty consistent finding, too. Yeah. I think the idea being that fathers suffer more when their kids leave because mothers all along have been more attuned to the emotional undercurrents in the house. And they've been way more alive to the tensions in the house. And they are by far and away the bigger disciplinarians. They're the bad cops, which is a hard job and a psychologically stressful job. So when that job is gone, you can't underestimate the hedonic power of relief, right? It's just easier. It's not that they don't miss their kids or don't love them. It's just that they were stressed out for so long and so taxed that there was something about, you know, like being released from that obligation that felt good to them. Whereas men, just kind of having been spared those burdens, then felt, you know, just they were able to just feel bad, just feel sad and mournful.
Well, Jennifer Senior, contributing editor at New York Magazine and author of All Joy and No Fun, this has been enlightening, and Kathy and I feel better, actually, about our parenting skills
good.
Early on.
I'm so glad. That's the only reason I feel like I was placed on this earth at this moment. So thank you.
Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thanks so much.
The art of painting in the great outdoors, also known as plein air, is highly influenced by Monet and Renoir and has emerged as a contemporary popular art form for the young and old alike. Each year, hundreds of the best plein air painters from all over the world apply to be chosen as participants in Plein Air Easton. And, according to our next guest, this is the largest and most prestigious plein air painting competition in the United States.
Joining us to shoot the breeze is Al Bond, Executive Director of the Avalon Foundation, which sponsors the event. Welcome, Al.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So what exactly is plein air?
Plein air is really painting from life. As opposed to using a photograph or one's memory, the subject is right in front of you. So it typically happens outdoors, but really a plein air painting can be made anywhere as long as you're looking at what is actually going to be painted.
So when did this movement begin? I mean, when did artists sort of move to the great outdoors and start painting?
Well, originally it was in France with the advent of a tube, which allowed paint supplies to be a lot more portable. But really, there have been a number of times in the United States. Certainly the Hudson Valley is a place that has had a major plein air movement back in the 19th century. Also in Pennsylvania, and certainly the California coast in the 20th century has been a major plein air center as well.
And I would imagine you need some really great scenery, right?
Yeah. I mean, one of the great things about plein air painting is that it encourages you to go out into the natural environment and really find beautiful things. And so the plein air painting movement is both about art and also about nature.
And Al, tell us about the level of competition to be selected to compete in your Plein Air Easton Festival. I mean, we hear it's really stiff.
It is. Yeah, we are really fortunate in that literally the best plein air painters in the world want to be in our competition. And there are 58 slots, and I will tell you there are more than 58 really great plein air painters in the world. Each year, a single jurist picks the competing artist for the year. And literally, we've had people apply from every continent except for Antarctica. if anybody out there knows some artists in Antarctica, we'd love to hear from them. But really amazing painters. And once they get here, they really do know that they're painting in a competition where their peers are among the best ever. And so they push themselves in Easton really like nowhere else.
And who actually judges the entries?
Well, this year it was Kip Forbes, who is the vice chair of Forbes magazine, or Forbes Inc., and also, as it happens, an avid art collector and very, very knowledgeable. So he was our jurist this year, and then the editor for Fine Art Connoisseur, Peter Trippi, is the judge of the event this year. So we have a different jurist and judge. A single jurist and a single judge makes all the decisions, and it changes every year.
So can you tell us where these people paint? I mean, do they just set up an easel along the side of the road, or where do they go in that county?
All over the place. I mean, one of the things about being a plein air painter is that you really do have to be pretty intrepid. And I've seen them in the middle of marshes painting, certainly on the sides of roads, all kinds of places. Once, during our quick draw, there was a man that was at the top of a 12-foot ladder to get exactly the right vantage that he was looking for.
Oh, my gosh. I hope he had good balance.
Well, he didn't fall, so.
That's good.
His paintings might have been worth more.
That's right. That's right.
It sold very quickly, I'll tell you.
So what are the prizes? What can they win?
Well, the grand prize, and this is our 10th year, and we actually increased it from a $5,000 prize to $10,000 for the grand prize. And all in all, there's a little less than $30,000 in total prizes across the various awards that are given.
So what happens to these beautiful paintings at the end of the festival? I mean, are they sold? Are they auctioned off?
Yeah,
or what
actually
happens?
What we do is after the painters have been working in first, the whole Eastern Shore, then Talbot County, then just Easton for 2 days each, they have to pick out their two best pieces for judging. Many of them will produce many, many more than that, but only two are available to be judged. And then, in our collector party, which is the opening event, they are both judged by the judge, but also available for sale. And literally, a painting sells about every 45 seconds for about 90 minutes straight during that party. And then the paintings are available throughout the weekend and replace every time a painting sells, another one is put on the walls and replaces it.
Well, we can't wait to attend. Al Bond, Executive Director of the Avalon Foundation, which organizes Plein Air Easton, the largest plein air festival in the United States. Thanks so much for sharing the news and the info with the Two Boomer Babes.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear. Look for FAST. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911 immediately. Know the sudden signs. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.